This is a 720 to go podcast from Chicago's WGN Radio 720.
This podcast is sponsored by ADM.
As one of the world's largest agricultural processors, ADM is uniquely positioned to serve the world's growing needs for abundant food and renewable energy. ADM.
When it comes to the business of America's farmland, you need the information from the people who know it best. That's why we bring you AgriCast with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong.
Well, thank you very much. And yes, good morning again. Good to be with you here on this Saturday morning. And for the coming week, we'll be working from the studio in Scottsdale, Arizona, where the town is filled with baseball teams and baseball fans with the beginning of spring training season here in the Valley of the Sun. We have a busy morning because we've had a busy week. The National Farm Machinery Show, and we'll get a report on that from Max. But tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to spend the first half hour of our show taking you back to last Saturday night in Greenville, South Carolina. And we'll meet the National Four Outstanding Young Farmers when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show. It's time to salute the nation's four outstanding young farmers for 2017. Honored a few days ago at the annual gathering of outstanding young farmers in Greenville, South Carolina. And for our first couple, we go to the state of Georgia and say hello to Ben and Julie Anna Boyd. And I've got to begin this by saying Georgia is ruling the agricultural world. We have a Secretary of Agriculture. We have the President of the American Farm Bureau Federation. We now have a National Outstanding Young Farmer.
Well, the other two are great guys.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear that. Let's talk about the great guy sitting here. How and when did you get started, and what are you doing today?
Well, I grew up in the middle of a cotton field, so I knew from day one all I wanted to do was farm. So following my daddy's footsteps, that's all I wanted to do was be a farmer. So I graduated from college in 1999, 2000, and I started renting land and borrowing capital and assuming risk. And so we started our crops then and had a few bad years, but we were able to persevere. The Lord was good to us, and here we are today, a little bit bigger and maybe with a little bit more backing than we had back then.
But you took on a major challenge for a young man. How do you get credit when you're that age?
Well, the greatest gift I ever had came from my father, and it was his name. I inherited his name, obviously, and I think people, he was a good man, and always made wise decisions, I think, and I think people in our community were willing to take a chance on me because of the track record that he had around, and I'm very grateful to him for that.
So what's the size and operation you have going today?
Well, Our farm consists of a kind of a loose partnership between my father and my brother and I, and we farm about 4,000 acres in southeast Georgia.
Been hit by some weather problems.
Well, yes, sir. Living on the coast, we're close to the ocean and close to the hurricane, so we get some pretty big weather events, and we've just now weathered a hurricane, and it'll test your mettle.
Julie, Anna, what kind of a role do you play in the farming operation today?
Well, as Ben can say, I'm the two ends, income and insurance. As farming, you know, you never know from year to year how income's going to be. So I work off the farm as an agriculture education teacher at our local high school and FFA advisor. And that helps, you know, provide a steady income to pay household bills, you know, from month to month, and also insurance and retirement for later down the road.
Well, I tell you, outside of my parents, the biggest factor in my life was my BOAG teacher. Do you get that feeling working with the young people that you do?
Yes, I do. A tremendous, you can see so much growth and so much, even from something like this. We train kids to do interviews and different things, which I'm not very good at, but you can see them go through and grow and win different things and accomplish, you know, different things towards agriculture. So.
And what about family?
We have one son. He's 3.5 years old. His name's Matt, and he thoroughly enjoys the farm. Like I was saying earlier, he just, you know, don't step on his fields in the living room. Don't run over his corn, his peanuts. You know, help me hook this up. Do this with the combine. So he enjoys.
Ben, what would you like to be doing 10 years from now?
Well, if I could be doing exactly what I'm doing now, I'll be satisfied. Our farm's at a sustainable level, I hope. I hope I can make a living. If we can make just enough money to do it one more year, that's what I want, because I'm really living the dream.
From the state of Georgia, National Outstanding Young Farmer Ben and Julie Anna Boyd. So we move from the state of Georgia to the state of Mississippi, and that's where we meet Brad and Molly Judson, one of the nation's four outstanding young farmers. And your first soybean crop was planted in your sandbox when you were 4 years old.
That's correct.
And what's it gone to since?
Well, we've gone from planting 1,500 acres of soybeans and farming 3,000 acres total to having less soybeans and more corn and cotton over the last few years.
Any livestock involved?
We got out of the livestock in probably 2011 and have gone just completely row crop since then.
So, located in Mississippi, where does your crop go when you harvest it? Does it head to New Orleans?
Well, most of our beans are, we send them down the 10-time waterway and they wind up in New Orleans and are exported. All of our corn is sold, goes to local feed mills eventually. We store a lot of it on farm and sell later on. You know, that on-farm storage kind of helps us streamline harvest and keep going. And our cotton, the last several years, has gone to a landed warehouse in Memphis and then exported from there.
That foreign market is so important. Molly, did you grow up on a farm?
I did not. I grew up in the city.
So was it sticker shock when you moved from the city to the farm?
Not too bad. It was actually a nice change.
So you've enjoyed it?
I have enjoyed it.
And how involved are you in the farming operation or off the farm?
You know, I'm not a wife that drives a tractor or does that type of thing, but more of the office work, PR with our landlords, and, you know, most of my time is spent with the family, taking care of our kids, making sure everything at home is running well, because in turn, our farm runs better.
And how many kids in the family?
We have two boys. Hamp is 13 and Howie is 11.
Ready to become farmers themselves, you think?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes. Not even a question. Well, I'll end up with this question for you, Brad. 10 years from now, what would you like to be doing?
Well, I certainly want to still be farming, but I really enjoy a lot of the special projects that we've done, the irrigation type stuff and improving the land. I'd like to do more of that and try and make sure that we have a place that's capable of supporting our children if that's what they choose. So that's the direction we're wanting to go.
How important is a college education in agriculture?
I think it's imperative. For one, it gives you a chance to grow up. And, you know, but you learn how to do things on your own, and you meet a lot of people from all over the country and different parts and different views. And
our congratulations to you, Brad and Molly Judson, from the state of Mississippi, one of the nation's four outstanding young farmers of 2017. We meet our third National Outstanding Young Farmer for 2017 from the state of Wisconsin. Honored recently in Greenville, South Carolina, as we say welcome and congratulations to Mark and Angie Alnitz. Let's find out, first of all, Mark, where you're farming and what kind of farming you're doing in America's Dairyland.
Yeah, Angie and I farm along the eastern side of Wisconsin in Valders, which is Manitowoc County, one of the most progressive dairy counties in all the country. We have an 80-cow registered Holstein farm that we manage our cows in a tie-stall barn, tunnel-ventilated barns with emphasis on cow comfort. We feel that if we take good care of our cows will take care of us. We've implemented as many progressive technologies as we can, things that we think will be good returns on investment, and a lot of those are cow comfort items such as fans, mattresses, and then genetics. We have a strong emphasis with registered Holsteins.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a moment. Still an important part of the dairy industry, genetics?
Yes, definitely. We try not to cut corners on our semen costs. We use all AI on our herd. We implement embryo transfer. We've been doing some in vitro work, and we feel that, you know, good cow families is the basis of all good genetics, and we've had some good cow families we've worked with that have been good good for our herd.
So let's talk about dairy cow families, and you're raising a family, but share with us some of the challenges you've had in raising kids and calves.
We are blessed with four beautiful, healthy children. Clarissa is 13, Garrett's 12, Whitney is 9, and Walker, our youngest, is 3. And there couldn't be a better way to raise a family than on a farm, working side by side, making memories. We tend to see our kids kind of tag along with us to the fun events like the fair, and we're seeing their passion of agriculture and the dairy industry just blossom kind of naturally by fault. I was a farm girl that grew up in Door County, and Mark and I both attribute a lot of our passion for agriculture to our parents that they instilled in us. And then after we got our degree at UW-Madison, we both combined our efforts, and we're each love of our lives, and now we're also farming and having a great life.
Raising cows and kids in mm-hmm. Wisconsin. What would you like to be doing 10 years from now?
Well, hopefully we're still enjoying what we're doing now. We aren't finished with achieving our goals. Our goal is to breed, excellent cows that are trouble-free and high-producing cows that are going to have high-component milk and low somatic cell count. So the type of cows any breeder would want to work with. We've built our brand, Regnar Holsteins, and trying to develop that on a state, local, state, and national level. And so hopefully we can keep continuing to further development of that. And as our kids get older, hopefully they decide that they'll want to be part of that as well.
Well, you've succeeded now as the National Outstanding Young Farmer, and we honor Mark and Angie Alness from Wisconsin, Outstanding Young Farmers of 2017. We meet our fourth and final National Outstanding Young Farmer for the year 2017 from the state of Illinois. This is Chad and Deb Bremer, who, even though they're south of Wisconsin, are still in the dairy business. Tell me a little bit, because it's a different dairy business for you.
Yes, we're in a custom dairy heifer raising business. We get calves when they're about 2.5 months old after they've been weaned a couple weeks. We bring them in, feed them, and then they go back to their respective dairies that they came from about 30 days before they freshen.
So you have them for quite a while.
Yeah, we average about 19 to 20 months that we have the cattle on our farm.
And how do you house that? Because that must mean a lot of cattle.
Yeah, we have about 750 head on feed most of the time. They start out in some open front calf barns with a bedded pack and move on at about 6 months of age. We move them into our freestall barn with sand bedding, and they're housed there. We have 7 different pens they rotate through, or artificially inseminated, and when they get to the other end, they're ready to go back and be mamas themselves.
And turn the calves over to you, and yes, you raise them. And I assume this is all contracted from individual dairy farmers.
Yes, yeah, we contract with 2 different dairies. One's a neighbor of ours, and the other one's about 25 miles away. And we've been with one since 2002 and the other one since 2008. So they've been long-term relationships.
Pretty good track record. Now, taking care of young calves takes nursing ability, and you're involved in that off the farm.
Yep, I work in nursing. I work part-time, 3 days a week, in the GI lab at Freeport FHN Memorial Hospital. And then I do get to help on the farm, too, as much as I can. A lot of times it's when they're in the field, and maybe they're busy, and I can surely feed the calves. So that's what the kids and I like to keep track of.
But you weren't a city girl. You grew up on a farm.
Yep, I grew up on a farm. When I was a little girl, I guess Mom and Dad had some pigs, and then I remember they had sheep. And then when they bought the bigger farm, we ventured into beef cattle and hogs.
Family? Do you have children?
Yeah, we have 3 boys. Benjamin is 12, Ethan is 10, and Eli is 7, and they're just about as passionate about farming as we are, ever since they were just little boys.
So you're raising 3 little farmers that are growing up rapidly, I'm sure.
That's right. I used to say all the crops we raised in little boys, but the little boys are kind of growing up.
Chad, 10 years from now, what would you like to be doing?
Well, hopefully I'm still doing the same things I am now, raising heifers. Hopefully we've been able to increase our cropping acreage some more, because my brother also farms with us, and he has two young boys himself. So there's five boys going to be coming, and hopefully we can make room for all of them to come back if they so choose.
But that will take some expansion.
Yes, it will.
To handle that many. Well, congratulations to you from Pearl City, Illinois. This is Chad and Deb Bremer, outstanding young farmers of 2017. It is 27 minutes after 5 o'clock, rapidly approaching news time here on WGN Radio's Saturday morning show. Here is a headline that we haven't seen for quite a few years. The headline in the Sacramento, California Bee newspaper this week: Sacramento, California on pace for the wettest year in a century. Story saying it hasn't rained this much, this fast in Sacramento during any year in more than a century. About 23.5 inches of rain had fallen in Sacramento between October 1 and February 10, according to the National Climatic Data Center. That's double the average for this point in the water year. So apparently the drought in California that's been going about a decade is indeed finally coming to an end. Today marks the start of National FFA Week, and 4-H members, or FFA members, well, many of them 4-H as well, across the country are going to be calling attention to the leadership training and the outstanding young people being built by FFA. And you know, I enjoy Culver's food, but I enjoy Culver's as much for what it does for agriculture and FFA, because Culver's Restaurants, of course, continues to have the Thank a Farmer campaign. But starting on Monday for National FFA Week, Culver's will kick off its third annual FFA essay contest to award three winners the funds to send their FFA chapters to the National FFA Convention and Expo in Indianapolis, October 25th of this year. The essay contest is asking FFA members to submit an essay in response to the following questions. As a future ag leader, what do you want people to know about the agriculture industry? How will you help in educating them on this subject? And Culver's will award prizes for the top three essays, providing winners with $7,500, $5,000, and $2,500 respectively to submit essays. FFA members should visit Culver's Corn, Culver's.com/essay contest, and the contest will end March 31st. So FFA members across the country, here's your chance to get your whole chapter to the FFA convention. And a good morning to you again as we continue our Saturday morning show, and we'll be talking markets and weather in South America. Dr. Mike Cordonier, you'll find him at soybeansandcorn.com. will be joining us shortly to talk about what's happening in our biggest corn and soybean competitors on the planet, Brazil and Argentina. But right now, we say welcome to Samuelson Says, brought to you by Wink Products Company, makers of quality specialty cleaning products since 1947. I'm Orion Samuelson. And today, a question I've asked many times before: when are we going to stop talking and start doing? If you're tired of your clothing being ruined by a spill or a stain, now there is hope. Thanks to the good folks at Wink, they have Wink Wash Away Laundry Stain Remover. This easy and safe to use pre-wash stain remover is a must-have in the laundry room for all washable color-fast fabrics, including wool, cotton, synthetics, and even cashmeres. And for those unexpected stains when you're on the go, watch them vanish with Wink Instant Spot Remover. Check out all of the Wink products at wink.com. That's WHINK.com. Welcome to Samuelson Says. Hello, everyone. I'm Orion Samuelson, once again trying to answer the question, whatever has happened to the inland waterway system? The folks at Wink Products Company want to help make your life easier with a family of professional strength cleaning products that really work. Wink Rust Stain Remover is the number one liquid rust stain remover in the country. This professional strength formula dissolves the ugly rust stains on white sinks and toilet bowls, color-fast fabrics, and carpets. This little brown bottle has been around for 69 years, and it's still number one. To learn where to find quality Wink products, check us out at WHINK.com. Every so often, I'm reminded of unfinished business, either by you in a letter or an email or a story that I see in the agricultural headlines. Well, this past week, the U.S. Grains Council held its 14th International Marketing Conference and 57th Annual Membership Meeting in Panama City, Panama. More than 350 people were on hand for that international gathering. And Chip Consul, who is chairman of the U.S. Grains Council and the grain farmer in Maryland, said when the council met last in Panama, the canal expansion was only a construction site. And now, after touring the new Panama Canal, now that it's open, it has become reality. Indeed it has. But why could Panama do that expansion of the canal in a relatively short time? And we are 60 or 70 years into delays on repairing and renovating the inland waterway system, locks and dams on the Mississippi and on the Illinois rivers. And along with this U.S. Grains Council story, I did get an email from a farmer in Iowa who said, "You haven't talked much about the inland waterway system and what's happening." Well, that's because apparently nothing is happening other than discussion and talking about it, something that we're very good at in Washington, D.C. and in other places in the U.S., but we're still talking, and the locks and dams are getting older and are continuing to deteriorate. There is a great opportunity for expansion of our world trade thanks to the Panama Canal increase in size, but we're not going to be able to take advantage of that if we don't do something about our waterway system. And so far, we're not seeing anything in the way of activity that is doing that. Congress continues to appropriate the funding for the rehabilitation and the renovation, but they appropriate it, but then don't write the check. Time to keep the pressure on. Let's get that waterway system improved. My thoughts on Samuelson Says.
Samuelson Says, a presentation of Tribune Radio Networks. And 21 minutes before 6 o'clock, we're ready to check in with Dr. Mike Cordoniere, and we'll do that when we continue here on the Saturday Morning Show.
It's always a pleasure to sit down with Dr. Michael Cordoniere of SoybeansAndCorn.com. to catch up on South America, because you have been there a great deal in your life, have you not?
Yes, and we just came back about 2 weeks ago after traveling through Brazil for a couple of weeks.
And you were there for the trucker strike?
Yeah, we was right there during the trucker strike, which meant that there was a lot of trucks parked along the side of the highways, but not as many on the road, so it made traveling, you know, a little bit easier.
From north to south in the country of Brazil, what are the well-known provinces that we keep an eye on for soybean harvest?
Well, you have to watch Mato Grosso. Mato Grosso is the number one state in Brazil for both soybeans and corn. They have about 27% of all the soybeans and about 35% of the corn production. So Mato Grosso is the equivalent of Iowa, Illinois, and half of Indiana. So that's how much soybeans they produce. So they're huge. So you have to watch Mato Grosso.
And are they the closest to the equator?
Yes, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
The middle part of Mato Grosso is about 13, 14 degrees south of the equator, about the same latitude as Panama is north of the equator.
Okay.
Now, the second state is Paraná, and Paraná is further south. So those two states combined have roughly just short of half of Brazil's production.
Let's talk about harvest progress, because while we're resting, they're working.
Yes. Brazil right now is about 25, maybe 28% harvested. About average. They got a lot of harvesting done the first part of January. Then it got very wet. Mato Grosso, while we were there, we was there for like 2 weeks. It rained every day except one. So didn't have a chance to see a single combine in the field because it was too wet. It has dried out somewhat since then. So they're making progress between the showers. And there was some concern, you know, if more wet weather comes in, you might have some quality concerns, that sort of thing. But for the time being, they're getting by.
And then let's look at Argentina, because I was telling you, somebody sent me some photographs of Argentine land. I didn't realize Argentina is totally flat.
It's as flat as a pool table.
Yeah.
So when they get a couple inches of rain, it just sets there. And unfortunately, right around Christmas, they got a lot of rain in the central part of the country, in provinces of Santa Fe, Entre Rios, northern Buenos Aires. And then they got some more around New Year's Day. But that has now drained away. So it did take out maybe 400,000 or 500,000 hectares of cropland. But always with flooding situation, you get floods, you know, eliminating some acres, but the other areas that weren't flooded had good moisture, so the crops are doing very good. So actually, I've been increasing my Argentine estimates as of late. And as always, you know, get your fingers crossed, they only get more rain, because then there would, you know, be more problems.
So let's talk about your estimates for Brazil and Argentina. Bigger crops?
Yes. Right now, I'm 105 million tons for Brazil soybeans. Last year, they did 95 million, so it's like 10 million tons more. It's going to be a record crop, without a doubt. And they're not quite in the bin in Brazil, but they're pretty close. So I don't see any major problems anymore for Brazil, unless it just gets super wet here for the next couple of weeks. Argentina, it's going to be a smaller crop than last year. Last year they did 56 million tons of soybeans. I have them at 54 million right now. So it's going to be down from last year. But the increase in Brazil is going to compensate for the losses in Argentina. So South America combined is going to have another record crop of soybeans.
China still buying a lot of South American beans?
Yes. The lineup for vessels is still very long. But we have a little bit of a window here for U.S. exports, because the rain has slowed down the harvest a bit in Brazil. So we're exporting a little bit more and a little bit longer than what we thought.
Let's go beyond grains and soybeans, and let's talk about meat, for example, because South America is becoming a major competitor there.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
In fact, Mexico sent a team of veterinarians to Brazil to certify meatpacking plants for both beef, pork, and poultry, because they want to start importing meat from Brazil. And Brazil's huge in meat exports, you know, huge. Same thing with Russia. Russia's got phytosanitary people in Brazil right now certifying plants and all that sort of thing. So the meat industry in Brazil had a couple of tough years because they had a shortage of corn. So last year, corn hit record prices. There was times last June you couldn't buy corn in Brazil at any price. No matter what you offered, it just wasn't available. Those days are past. They're harvesting the full-season corn now. They've got a big second crop of corn coming on. Corn prices have really, really gone down, which is good for the meat industry. So the meat industry is taking advantage, and they're ramping up their production.
And I would guess they're looking at the possible problems between the U.S. with the new administration and some of our current buyers.
Yes. Both Brazil and Argentina view the U.S. sort of pulling out of TPP, reluctance with NAFTA, as an opportunity for them to step in. No, United States, Brazil, and Argentina, we sell the same products to the same countries. So when one pulls back a little bit, it opens the door for the other ones.
So trade can be a problem for us if we continue to do what we're doing with agreements, you're saying?
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a big world out there. Mexico and the Asian countries don't have to buy from the United States. They can buy some of the products from other countries as well.
Are you making any guesstimates on the U.S. crops this year?
Well, there's a lot of speculation on acreage. I think the soybean area is going to go up maybe 3 or 4 million acres. Corn go down maybe 3 million. But there's still a lot of doubt. And I don't think the corn area goes down as much as what we thought a couple of months ago. Corn price is like $4 a bushel.
Right.
And that's sort of a psychological point for farmers. So if they keep strengthening a little bit, I think beans will go up, corn will go down, but maybe not as much as what we anticipated. And, of course, we get the outlook meeting from the USDA, then the planting intentions in the March. And then all that focuses into the weather. If you have a nice, open, dry spring, that always favors corn acres. So I think there's still some doubt about the acreage.
Where can people get in touch with you to carry on conversations or get information?
You can always go to soybeansandcorn.com. That's my website. I put a lot of stories there. Then you can also send me an email at soycorn@comcast.net. And always glad to answer your questions.
And you will do that because I know when we get in touch with you, we do hear back from you.
I try to answer questions as quickly as possible. I spend a lot of my day answering questions.
When will your next trip to South America take place? Have you decided?
Well, it won't be until the fall or maybe, right, you know, November, December. We were there looking at the soybean harvest. Unfortunately, it rained all the time. And the safrinha corn planting. So the next big thing in Brazil, in fact, most of my questions right now is about the Brazilian corn crop, more so than a Brazilian soybean crop. Right now, they're planting the safrinha corn. It's maybe 25% planted. The ideal planting window is going to close here towards the end of February. So the question is, will they get it planted on time? How big will it be? No one knows, of course. It's going to depend on the weather during March, April, and May. And right now, the forecast, long-range forecast, is not very good. They're calling for hot and dry weather during March, April, and May. So we'll see.
So the harvest of the second crop corn gets underway when?
They start in June. It probably peaks in July and August. And then it's that second crop that goes into the export channels. The first crop of corn was like one-third of the total corn in Brazil. That all goes to the livestock industry.
Right.
None of that goes to export. So all the export corn comes on the market June, July, and August. And then they started exporting about August and peaks September, October, November. And that's when they go into the export market with corn.
I can remember the days we didn't even talk about Brazil and Argentina for soybeans or corn.
Absolutely. Years ago. We go back a long way, Warren.
Yes, we do.
But starting in the 80s, Brazil came on strong. Argentina's coming on strong. There's plenty of land. They got the weather. They got the know-how. And they just keep getting bigger and bigger.
Well, thank you for joining us. We always look forward to the visit with Dr. Michael Cordonier. Again, that address to reach him, soybeans, plural, soybeansandcorn.com. It's 8 minutes before 6 o'clock, and thank you for joining us here on the Saturday Morning Show. It's our weekly get-together to look at the world of agriculture and agribusiness. And you've heard me say it many times, if you eat, you're involved in agriculture. That doesn't leave many of us out. A lot of people went to Louisville, Kentucky, and still are this week because it's the National Farm Machinery Show and the National Tractor Pullers Association competition. And among those who traveled to Louisville, of course, was Max Armstrong. So let's check in with him because we're about getting ready to wrap it up, aren't we, Max?
They will wrap it up today, Orion, at Louisville for the 52nd National Farm Machinery Show. And for most farmers who attend, it's just a matter of looking at equipment, looking at new goods and services, talking with company representatives. But there are some seminars that are held during that show, too. And I was asked by the Association of Equipment Manufacturers to moderate one of those the other day in Louisville on infrastructure. What is necessary? What do we need to do to improve our infrastructure to serve the agriculture industry? One of those on the panel was Leif Magnusson, who's the executive overseeing CLOS, the Farm Equipment Company.
First of all, I think this is such a timely dialogue with a new administration on board and President Trump as a candidate during his campaigning talked very much about how we need to rebuild the infrastructure in the United States. So first of all, timing. Second thing is that I see infrastructure and economic growth go hand in hand. It's a twofold relationship. The better our infrastructure can be, the more we can produce and the more efficient we can be, and that in turn will also drive the need for new infrastructure. Infrastructure, two things I can see. It's the good old infrastructure in transportation, whether it's roads, rail, or waterways. And certainly there's a lot of work that needs to be done in those three areas. The new thing on the table is building infrastructure for technology. Specifically, I'm talking about broadband connectivity. And as you heard on the panel, about 17% of the U.S. population does not have access to broadband. About 50% of the rural communities have broadband access that is slower than 25 megabits per second. Too slow if you want to employ the technology that we are now and will be incorporating into our machines.
Leif Magnusson is his name. He's at Kloss, the Farm Equipment Company. And also on that panel was Jason Andringa, President and CEO of Vermeer Manufacturing, headquartered in Pella, Iowa.
I think some of the key things are that infrastructure is a bipartisan topic. And there's really a lot of talk and there's a lot of desire to improve the infrastructure, and for good reason. Our infrastructure could use the improvement and could use the expansion. So I think as a manufacturer, we see that we need better roads, we need better ports, we need better broadband infrastructure, and it's really all of those different types of agriculture. And President Trump talks about $1 trillion investment. And I really think not only could that improve the lives of all Americans enjoying the benefits of better infrastructure, but would put a lot of people to work, and the sort of pass-through of the economics of that could be extremely beneficial.
Will rural America have a difficult time being heard in this? Obviously, we tend to think of the interstates around the big cities. We think of the ports around big cities along the coasts. Will rural America get its share?
Rural America was definitely very impactful in the last election. So I think the understanding of the role that rural America plays is maybe at a higher level than where it's been in several years. And certainly when it comes to producing food, that not only that the U.S. depends upon, but the globe depends upon, because the U.S. is a remarkable agricultural producer. I think the voice of rural America is an important one, and maybe one which is more well heard now than what it was in the past.
Jason Andringa, he's president and CEO of Vermeer. And yes, they make agriculture equipment, haying equipment, and they're in the forestry business. They make wood chippers, for example. They also are involved in construction, and broadband is near and dear to their hearts because they make that equipment that will snake that broadband fiber optic cable under roads and highways. So it was an interesting panel discussion. Also participating was the president of the American Farm Bureau, Orion Zippy Duvall. We enjoyed once again having the chance to visit with Zippy.
I think American Farm Bureau is in the hands of good leadership with Zippy Duvall as their president. And Max, I know it's not easy to spend all day, every day at that farm machinery show, but thanks for doing it, and thanks for checking in with us this morning. The other farm machinery event that took place this past week in Tulare, California, World Ag Expo. And there they celebrated their 50th year, and apparently the show ended before the rain started, because they're getting rain in that part of California as well. So again, we want to mention the fact that it's National FFA Week starting today, continuing through Saturday, and looking ahead to next week, an annual event in Washington, D.C. It's the USDA National Agricultural Outlook Forum. Traditionally, the Secretary of Agriculture speaks at that event, so it'll be interesting to see if Sonny Perdue will be at that event and on the program. As we ended the week on market activity, the livestock futures yesterday showing some gain, some strength again. It's continuing to be an up and down market. But April lean hogs ended at 70.77, a gain of 82 cents for the day yesterday. February live cattle up $1.47 at $117.92. March feeder cattle up 15 cents a hundredweight. Red screen in the grain market yesterday, however, with the March wheat down 5.25 cents, March corn down 5 cents, and March soybeans down 9 cents a bushel. Well, in Phoenix, Arizona this week, coming up on Tuesday, the annual Phoenix Agriculture Club Outlook Program, and I'll be there to MC a portion of that. And always an interesting story to tell there as the Western agricultural scene takes its look at what's coming up ahead. So we look forward to joining a lot of people there, and a lot of them from the Midwest, incidentally, who have either retired to Arizona or who are out here hoping to catch some sun. It may be liquid sun for the next 2 or 3 days. And they're talking about an inch of rain falling in the Phoenix Scottsdale area. And when your average rainfall is 8 inches, an inch is quite a downpour. As always, Max and I appreciate your joining us here on the Saturday morning show, and we hope you'll all pay tribute to the FFA folks across the country during National FFA Week. So thank you for joining us on Chicago's very own 720 WGN and WGNradio.com.
Orion Samuelson keeps you connected to the world of business and agriculture on WGN. Hear his reports weekday mornings on The Steve Cochran Show and during the noon hour on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Plus, catch Orion and Max on Saturday mornings at 5 a.m. only on Chicago's WGN Radio 720.